Good evening. My name's Peter Stothard. I'm the editor of The Times, and it's a great delight to welcome you all to this Times Dylan's Forum. For reasons that are both personal and professional, it's a particular pleasure for me tonight to introduce David Selborne and his book, The Principle of Duty. As some of you may have noticed, The Times has become something of a sponsor of this book. Last month, we wrote a top leading article about it, and since then, the responses from our readers have been pouring in. For a newspaper to endorse any particular book in its editorial columns rather than its review pages, it's a rare thing, and something that newspaper editors should do at their peril, particularly if they ever want to associate with other publishers. But the importance of the principle of duty is very clear to me, and as those of you who read extracts of it, which we published in the Times last month, will by now, I hope, have realized that, and I hope that is why you're here to talk to David about it. Personally, I've been very intrigued by the number of senior politicians in this country who've come up to me in recent weeks with an opinion about it. David certainly has some admirers amongst the highest in the land, and he also has some very severe detractors. There's certainly one very senior Conservative politician who came up to me last night incandescent with anger at the Times espousal of this book. I'd probably be fair to him not to name him, but and of course you may have read that President Clinton bought a copy last week, and when we come to the question, some of you may give us some idea as to why you think he might have done such a thing. I'll leave the exposition of the book entirely to David, but I would just explain, before I sit down, my own particular personal interest in David and his work. It stretches back to 1986, when he was still teaching at Ruskin College, Oxford, and the Times in the middle of a serious industrial dispute. And it was with him at Ruskin and with us at Wapping that his personal academic freedom, in this case to write for the Times, came directly into a clash with the collective political intolerance of those of his colleagues who placed blind obedience to some notion of theirs above the liberty of David to write what he wanted to write, where he wanted to write it. Now, at that time, he was developing a critique of left-wing ideas. But since then, he's turned his attention, as some of you will know, to the post-communist world, to the flaws in modern liberal society. He's no less a critical of the free market orthodoxies of the right as he is of liberal human rights theorists and socialist doctrine. There's no intellectual school that's free from the coruscating approach that David Selborne brings. Now, I believe there's a great yearning for that approach. Times readers certainly tell me so. And as you know, there are more Times readers now than at any time in our history. So when they tell me, I have to take them very seriously. Last year, there was the murder of James Bulger, and that was a trigger, was called a trigger, for a great debate about the decline of civic responsibility and the end of community bonds, as many people saw them. But I think that was a debate that was already waiting to happen. There is a rising sense of anxiety today, embracing crime, irresponsible parenthood, low standards in education, and much else besides. And sometimes these fears are exaggerated, including by journalists. But there are too many of them, and they're too great to be ignored. And when you hear Tony Blair talking about them, and Michael Portillo talking about them, and now we're going to hear David giving some grounding, I hope, on which we can help to understand them better, because this is a discourse that's been ignored for too long. And so I know there's much in this book that will provoke and has provoked fierce criticism, not just from senior conservatives who I meet in garden parties, but there's a lot that's angered a lot of other people too. But there's also a lot that has inspired people. There's a lot that will continue to inspire people. This is a book which I know that many people will want to read and many people will want to keep. For that purpose, it's possible to buy it. Some of you may have bought it as you came in. Others can buy it as you leave. David will sign it, which some signed books aren't worth the paper they're written on or the ink that the signature is made in. But in my belief, this is one that will be and is. And I hope as many of possible of you take advantage of that opportunity when David has finished. And it is now my very great pleasure to introduce to you David Selborne.
It was Hazlitt, that Shakespeare of English prose, who declared that to expect an author to talk as he writes is ridiculous. Or even if he did, you would find fault with him as a pedant. We should read authors, said Hazlitt, and of course I agree with that, and not converse with them. And I might add, nor have them lecture at us. Nevertheless, I've permitted myself to be dragged from Italy for the purpose, and to hear these handsome remarks from the editor of the Times, and I thank you for coming to hear me. As I thank the Times, and you, Mr. Chairman, in particular, and Matthew D'Ancona, for your interest in my essay. In my view, the best of journalists, and I speak from experience of this, always knows more than the best of academics about how the world wags and is likely to wag in future. Thackeray's comic Captain Shandon, who is editor or was editor of his fictional Pall Mall Gazette in Pendennis, thought that little good came out of writing for newspapers. He preferred to live in France, drinking cheap brandy at 2 francs a bottle. But it all depends which newspapers. It might be true of some newspapers, but not, I think, of your renascent paper, or at least I hope that it is renascent and it gives every sign of being. That the Times should have devoted editorial attention, even first leaders, to works of philosophy is to be commended. Of course, I'd be bound to say that in the circumstances, but I also believe that I speak for many Times readers in applauding what you've done, I hope reasonably objectively. I must also thank Christopher Sinclair Stevenson, who's here tonight, for his confidence in my purposes, as well as for the exemplary speed and energy with which the book was published. No word of it was written a year ago. I faced the proverbial and daunting blank page on June the 9th last, and brought it to an end, at least the first draft, on August the 12th, because it was getting too hot in Italy. And that is the secret reason why the last chapter is so short. Many have subsequently been involved in its production. Bear with me if I say that I thank particularly Claire Blackwell, Roger Cazalet, Debbie Clement, Katie Collins, Frank Dunn, Chris Holgate, and Spencer Wilkes among them, together with Christopher Sinclair Stevenson himself, who's much involved in the production of the book and getting it out, and I thank them all. Now, in my temerity, I have in mind, in my book, The Principle of Duty, nothing less, and it is temerity to say this, nothing less than the refoundation of a national civic philosophy posited upon the fulfillment of duties, of the duties of the civic order to its citizens, I emphasize that, and upon the fulfillment by its citizens of their duties to themselves, to their fellows, and to the civic order to which they belong. Indeed, I may as well protest now, at this early stage in the life of my book, at the reductiveness of some of the first accounts of what it contains. Some critics are addressing themselves to a book I did not write and are asking why not. They're even suggesting that if they weren't so wretchedly busy, they'd have written it better themselves. I'm even being told what is it about by individuals, including the chief rabbi, incidentally, who have not read it, or who could not possibly have read it with any care. I don't deny for a minute that it is, though readable, I hope, complex also in its implications. I think I ought also to repeat at the outset that the ethical and practical obligations of the civic order to its members, not least to seek to ensure that they are materially able to fulfil their citizens' parts, plays a fundamental part in my essay. You will find no offensive beggars in my text. Moreover, as to the sanctions which are required, in my belief, ultimately, to secure observance of citizen responsibilities, I make clear many times in my essay, too many perhaps, repetitiously even, a moral preference for the voluntary fulfilment of obligation, stating categorically, in a particular section, section 229, to be Hazlitt's pedant, that the principle of duty is in essence a principle of moral expectation, that expectation should have ethical priority over invitation to duty, to responsibility, invitation over inducement, and inducement over compulsion, or anything that smacks of it. But I'll say also, to make the matter quite clear, that I am not in the least squeamish about the need for certain kinds of civic sanction. For those who will the ends must also will the means, and it is too much the weakness of liberal thinkers that they will do one but not the other. I began my book from the position that in the wake of the socialist debacle, which is what I consider it to have been, that these are times of upheaval and transformation in our political and social thinking. And good that it is so. Welcome that it is so. These are also times for a civic reckoning, as Peter Stoddart indicated. Times for the political philosopher, if I can be so brazen as to call myself that, with some hesitation, nevertheless, times for the political philosopher to think civically. It's a grand call to which thinking people have a duty to respond. It's also times, these are also times, in my judgment, to be free, and it's a welcome time, to be free from all dogmatic political presupposition, save one. But the principles of the civic order, that civic order which is the organizing principle of our associative life, of our life together, the only political order that we know, and the terrain for the exercise of our freedoms, that the principles of that civic order require to be known, and the civic order itself protected from dissolution. This is my overriding purpose. I stand entirely at odds with those who idly proclaim the end of history, the death of philosophy, the bankruptcy of economics, and so on. In fact, there have been numerous books published in recent period with titles of that sort. Rather, in The Principle of Duty, I adopt somewhat didactic tone, not only of somebody who spent years teaching, but of one more particularly who believes that the tradition of civic philosophical thinking, Greco-Roman, Judeo-Christian, there is such a thing, liberal democratic, in which I have the very great good fortune to be educated myself, needs to be rediscovered. resumed and put to the service of the reconstitution of what I call throughout my book, to the irritation of some, our corrupted liberal orders, and a new reconciliation found between the claims of liberty and the claims of order. I say personally now, because I think I need to say it, I have an obligation to say it in some respects, that I did not have to look far for my principles, many of which are Judaic. Sufficient are an anxiety for our future, which no reasoning person can fail to share, a sense of the actuality of the past within the present, which grows greater as I grow older myself, a belief in the centrality of education to the ordering of civic life, the idea of duty as service to the community, and fear and dislike of unreason, dislike and fear of the brute in man, which I don't hesitate to describe, and I think we should be bold enough to face, and a desire for justice to be seen to be done to the dutiless, the acivic, the anti-civic, and the violent. This may be too personal, but I recall my father, who was steeped in a sense of self-respecting duty to others, and who was a very fine medical diagnostician. My concern is, and I think it always was in my old socialist days and in my earlier days as a liberal, even with a large L, undergraduate at Oxford, with the related ills of the civic order. Above all, my essay is addressed to the young, among them to those whose hopes of a better and more decent world are intact, despite the harm which has been done to our damaged and corrupted liberal orders by my political generation, both right and left. Like the Pied Piper, they've led some up the ethical gum tree of the free market and others up the garden path of an egalitarian heaven on earth. And that sentence will help to explain why I'm being assailed from left and right. The moment is propitious for a return to certain first civic principles of morality and government. Dismay at the visionless of many of our political representatives, I believe, is at a height, and in many countries, I come from one where this dismay has been very great and with good and with justice. But at least on the positive side, old left and old right are being freed by their own failures to think again. But those on both left and right who've helped to establish the ideological domination of a politics of what I call relentlessly in my book, and again without apology, a politics of dutiless right, demand satisfaction, and what I call self-realization through unimpeded freedom of action, still have a lot to answer for. I believe that they have helped to set in train destructive social processes which are carrying the civic order into quickening dissolution and disaggregation, and which they themselves seem powerless to arrest. Now, the confusion in Britain seems to me very great. There are some about who, in the teeth of a diminishing sense of civic responsibility, would even give the citizen more dutiless rights in the name of citizenship itself. There are others who, discrediting the very notion of a civic order, would sell off the state, the instrument of the civic order itself, by lot to the highest bidder. Others, again, would surrender the integrity of the national civic order and its capacity to determine how best to meet its citizens' needs and interests into the hands of supranational bodies, while everybody goes about blaming their neighbours, the next person, that category called them, for failing to do something about this or that civic failure. And this is happening in Britain, a constellation of nations with, and who can forget it, 50 years after D-Day, a truly civic tradition. It's quite extraordinary that one should even have to say this, whose political philosophers in Britain's heyday, thought out and taught the principles of civic order to the world. And I think that those who know this tradition have a duty to stand to it now for all the defects and amendments to it which are required. Because we know, or should know, that the secure possession of rights, the liberal spirit of toleration, and the pluralism of the social fabric can't prosper without the maintenance of the civic bond and without observance of the principle of duty. I consider it to be the keystone of civic thought. I consider it to be the principle of civic coherence, and I think it has ethical precedence over all other principles, however important those other principles are. I don't believe that living by the rule of dutyless right is a civic life. I don't think the civic order can be regarded as merely a casual locus for the self-interested in a relation of merely casual agglomeration with others. That is to be in a truly tragic plight, and it is the source of a large amount of our anxiety and depression and dismay. To adopt Abraham Lincoln, if dutyless right is not wrong ethically, then nothing is ethically wrong. And I have to say also, because today I've been accused of being, monstrously accused of being a fascist by Austin Mitchell, that not only is the principle of duty compatible with the liberal ideal, it's essential to the maintenance of a liberal democratic civic order, of which my book is a passionate defence. Now, I've set my book against quite a large number of things, and this is why a certain amount of spleen has been aroused. I've set it against the failures of the civic order to fulfil certain of its obligations to the citizen body. And for the last 15 years, large numbers of the obligations of the civic order to its citizens have not been met. I've also set it against, with dispassionate even-handedness, the transformation of so many citizens into strangers and welfare subjects. Above all, I've set it against the overwhelming of every other principle, and especially the principle of duty, by the politics of rights, 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 and more rights. Rights as an article of faith, rights as the object of individual aspiration, while duty is seen as some kind of obstacle to free self-expression. Rights as the sole criterion of civic existence, rights as the main item on the agenda of conflict between the political parties. There's one party which seeks to offer us chartered customer rights. There's another party which offers us chartered, promises us chartered welfare rights if they win the next election, but more of them, better secured. A third party offers us, reasonably, rightly, a chartered bill of rights, but not of duties. In the last weeks and months, we've faced discussions in the press and elsewhere of the rights, about the rights of children to divorce their parents. I'm choosing at random some of the issues that have come into public discussion. Rights to post-menopausal in vitro fertilization. Rights to carry out sadistic acts of genital torture with consent, as was discussed and argued in Regina against Brown in 1993. Perhaps, too, we may face discussion of rights to murder, or maybe rights to eternal life on a heavenly dole. So no limit to this. Indeed, there may not be, because in last week's Guardian I saw in the newspaper a proposal for a dead citizens' charter. No joke it was. It was a seriously argued piece by Michael Young of extraordinary content, which suggested that we shall not pay for our sins even in the hereafter if the welfarist gets his way. Now, the only possible alternative to this is a civic politics, a politics of duties as well as of rights. On the part of the civic order, as I set out in my book, they include obligations to enforce the principle of duty itself, to deny the citizens' claims to dutyless right, to defend our civic bond, which has brought me and you and the editor of the Times together in here with a common purpose, which is to hear someone speak of, in my case, to try to write about, what I consider to be a civic philosophy. The civic order has a duty to prevent the transformation of citizens into strangers through errors of public policy, to protect the citizen from violence. That is a commonplace. But to educate the citizen to his citizen's part, and to seek to meet the material needs of the people so that the lack of material goods will never prevent an individual from voluntarily playing his citizen's or her citizen's part. On the other hand, I've set out in my book, I don't want to rehearse the whole of the argument, what I consider to be the ethical and other obligations of the citizen, some of which can and should be enforced, and some of which must be left to ethical expectation alone, as I said earlier, but which include the duty to exercise co-responsibility for the well-being of the civic order to which they belong, to maintain undertakings and relations, this is the most unfashionable doctrine, including familial and marital relations. And how quick people are to hear in that proposal the voice of reaction and not what I consider it to be, the voice of progress. I consider it to be an obligation to find work in and to share the work of the civic order. We've reached such a state of being surrounded by taboos that is regarded as unacceptably authoritarian. This is the plight of the civic order, that it should be so considered. And there may be many in this audience who themselves feel their hackles rise at a proposal which has been commonplace in the civic thinking of every human association since human association began. That sort of notion is a commonplace in the history of civic philosophy. Now, as far as the failure of the civic order to discharge its obligations are concerned, I feel particularly exercised about the way in which, as I said earlier, our civic order, this civic order which we inhabit and of which we are all fellow citizens, has failed to sustain and defend and maintain those institutions which provide our sense of civic identity, to sell off, whether in whole or in part, the Royal Mail, the prison service, police functions, and as was suggested in The Guardian last week, social security and other appeals tribunals, the Inland Revenue, or parts thereof, to a firm in Dallas, which was set up by Ross Perot, and which is now owned by General Motors, the water authorities, the National Air Traffic Control System, customs and excise functions, functions of the schools inspectorate, the vehicle licensing system, and many other civic agencies, and I use the word designedly, is to put out to tender the obligations of the civic order to the civic body, that is, to us. It is, blow by blow, to strike at the very heart of British civic life. It is to cut the ethical ground from under the feet of those who otherwise justly seek to re-moralise citizen conduct in the interests of all. There is a rising politician, who out of politeness I will not name, who objected recently to the subcontracting of compassion to the state. But he cannot, this individual, Janus-like, simultaneously subcontract the state's own ethical obligations to mere profiteers or to have a hand therein. It is an entire contradiction, and it is one of the things that I believe the electorate has found out. and does not like. To deny that, as infamously was denied, that there is such a thing as society at all, is to deny the civic order itself. A former government minister a few days ago declared that it was unconscionable, that was his word, yes, unconscionable, to hesitate over further privatisation. That is to abandon civic conscience itself, and especially to use the word unconscionable of what is itself an unconscionable position, is quite abhorrent. For those who hold such views, if I can quote Burke, and of course somebody who was an old socialist is not supposed to quote Burke or even to read him. For those who hold such views, as Burke might have said and did in his own time, are a faction that has been driving hard to the ruin of the country. And while I have the editor of the Times here, he thinks he has me captive, but perhaps the boot is on the other foot, I call on him to pay heed to these objections upon an issue which has nothing to do with right or left, for it is a civic issue. Now, what disturbs me, as a lawyer by training, is that against the privatisation of civic institutions, only the feeblest political and ethical opposition has been mounted, whether in Parliament, in the courts, especially, or the pulpit. Legislators, judges and divines have astonishingly failed in their constitutional and moral obligations throughout this period to defend our civic order from the privateer who's been making off with its institutions. And I think a great deal of probably irremediable damage has been done. In my judgment, a commercial or profit-making organisation acting in its own private interests cannot ethically be made responsible, for instance, for supervising the loss of liberty of fellow citizens who have offended the rules of the civic order. To delegate such responsibilities is sooner or later to undermine, I think sooner, to undermine the moral status of law enforcement itself. Running a prison or an immigrant detention centre like the one outside Oxford is not the same as running a hotel, as Theresa Gorman indicated that she believed it was. For, if I can quote Hazlitt again, self-interest cannot supply the place of principle. At any rate, I can gather from the response which the book has so gratifyingly had thus far, despite certain hostilities which have broken out to left and right of me, that the discovery of this plain civic truth, and there will be many people perhaps in this audience who think these are all plain civic truths which are so self-evident they need not be mentioned, but I can assure you that it is not so, the rediscovery of this plain truth I think is at hand, and it is historically just, given the surviving strength of the British civic tradition, that it should be so. There are dull, complacent efforts being made in the newspapers by some of our leading commentators to suggest that ideas, for example, have no part to play in the labour contest. There is a certain individual commentator who's been repeating this ad nauseam and insisting that only personalities count in this contest. Now, it's quite true, as I know from bitter experience, that the labour movement has an authoritarian hostility to new ideas, and I might add, even to any ideas at all. But it also is true that the long-suppressed notion of citizen obligation as an organising principle of the civic order is making a welcome reappearance in Labour's ranks. However meekly, however cautiously, and with whatever terror of what I called in The Guardian not long ago, the actions of Boxgrove Man in its ranks. That man recently dug up somewhere on the south, near the south coast, who has been resuscitated, will be resuscitated in the debates to come in the Labour Party, and whom I describe as forever grinding his stone axe, ready to club down the merest suggestion of a new thought. Now, I say reappearance because I think these ideas are a reappearance in labour ranks. Why do I say reappearance? Think how far we have got from the time of the Webbs in 1948, who felt able to say, without fear of the sort of comradely or fraternal reprisal which I suffered, that the fact that sick and unemployed persons are entitled to money incomes without any corresponding obligation to get well and keep well, or to seek and keep employment, said the Webbs in 1948, seems to us likely to encourage, and then they used a dreadful word, I admit it's dreadful, likely to encourage, God help us, malingering. This was the Webbs in 1948. It's not possible to use such a word. Indeed, it is an unpleasant word, and as the son of a doctor, I know that the word malingering was used with the greatest of cautions, and rightly so. It's not often that doctors are so incautious, or it wasn't in my father's case, as to use it. But in less squeamish times than these, in political debate, the Webbs did not hesitate to use it, and to write it, or take Tawney. In his book Equality, which was published in 1931, he could actually dare to say that public provision should be adequate in amount, but its use should be discriminating. And the more it increases, the greater the need for discrimination becomes. Even adding, in his revised edition of 1950, particularly in times of unemployment. Why? Because, said the brave Tawney, or he seems brave to us now, because of the danger of encouraging, God help us, social what? Malingering. This is Tawney, the same dreadful word. That taboo word used both by Tawney and the Webbs. And you see how distant we are, thinking civically, trying to think civically, trying to write civically, from commonplace civic, or what I call, in this particular case, ethical judgments about the bad citizen. Now, though there are civic straws blowing in the wind from the left, the taboo upon discussion on the left of the bad citizen remains. And as long as that's so, as long as the very idea of worth and unworthiness in citizen conduct is a taboo subject for fear of offending, then Labour's essential commitment to the politics of dutiless right becomes gradually manifest. There cannot be a critique or criticism of the bad citizen and of worth and unworthiness in citizen conduct on the left because of the taboo about offending those to whom the Labour Party appeals. This is a tragic dilemma, and I even feel now speaking that there's a certain degree of reproach of me, perhaps in some, at having raised this subject. I feel as if I'm walking on eggshells, and I ought not to feel it, because these were commonplaces of civic and ethical discussion a mere handful of years ago. But we seem constrained by taboo from raising these subjects for fear of being regarded as pariahs, of having broken some unspoken code. As long as that's the case, for Labour, I don't believe that it will be able to arrive at a persuasive civic politics at all. However, I see that this coming Saturday, some of the luminaries of the left are gathering at the International Maritime Centre. Strikes me as a suitable place for those who are at sea. In order to ask themselves, a pretty daft question it sounds, whatever next? The answer, I fear, and I'm still capable of thinking it tragic that it should be so, will be intellectually not much. They wish, so they have declared, to create a popular front of the mind, a truly dreadful phrase, and to fire the nation's imagination. This is a very hard thing to do at the best of times, and it's And it's a damn sight harder to achieve it through competitive self-interrogation of the kind to which the narcissistic left, of which I was doubtless a member in my own time, has always been given. In any case, we need answers, not more questions. And I'm arrogant enough to think that it is a civic philosophy and a civic politics founded upon it which is next. Now, a civic policy, politics and philosophy has to be a philosophy and politics both of rights and duties. Duties to the self included, as I've set them out in my book. And, as I've made plain already, a philosophy and politics which doesn't fear out of a sense of taboo to call things by their correct names and by the names by which they were once called when people were bolder and intellectually more honest in discussing the issues which concern and dismay us. But at least we can say after the collapse of socialism, old socialism, that there's no reason to fear that there will be a cessation in the battle of ideas despite these taboos. One of my favourite books, Flaubert's Sentimental Education, has in it a lawyer, de Laurier, who says that you don't need dogmas to keep the streets clean. Though dogma got into street cleaning well enough in this allegedly anti-ideological country not a few years ago. Moreover, the British know as well as any that the truth is that our whole life is startlingly moral. There is never an instant's truce between virtue and vice, two most unfashionable words, and as long as that is the case, the battle of political ideas must continue. We are also at the early stages of an intellectual revolution in political ideas, which the next generation will carry forward. To gauge its present scope, for those who might be sceptical, and I don't really think that many are, about the fact that an intellectual revolution, however incoherent, is underway, you only have to glance in Britain and the United States at the civic measures which are currently being floated and are in the air, the civic reforms which are being planned, and the new civic rules which have already been enacted. Choosing at random, this is at random, they range over numerous schemes for national voluntary service, which taboo shrinks from, even that. Payment of compensation by offenders to their victims, taboo shrinks from that too. Fines related to income, oh horror. Community service as a title of access to higher education. What a dreadful proposal. Some might think that. The linking of public provision and benefit to the acceptance of work. Is that fascist? The increase of sanctions for the neglect of parental responsibility for children. Emergency measures that the government has been trying to take against tremendous opposition to raise standards of education, and so on. Now, the left sees these matters, those which have to do with the civic and with duty, as being essentially bourgeois. Now, let's face that for a moment, passing moment. They perceive, in general, that duty is something akin to fealty or obedience or obeisance on bended knee. It has a feudal ring to it. Duty is seen as in some way an oppressive derogation from a politics of rights. I know that because I faced a fierce argument this afternoon precisely on that subject. One of the proposals I've just mentioned is regularly referred to by one of the Labour candidates for the leadership as forced labour. But history has meted out, in my view, as an old socialist, a just price to this kind of old socialist reflex for its ethical all-knowingness, for its counterproductive social and economic ideas. Yet left foolishness, I have to say, is constantly manifest in Britain, even if some of the Marxist hedonists, as I call them, with whom I once consorted in the 60s and 70s, have had their time and they've had their day, together with their, what I consider to be, and I speak from passionate insight into this, their bad faith, because I suffered from attacks of bad faith too, and riskless attitudinizing, and I know all about that also. riskless attitudinizing. It reminds me of the immortal Sam Goldwyn. She put it, the most important thing in acting is honesty. Fake that and you're in. another issue which, despite the increasing heat in this room, I want to raise is this, which I don't see raised. What I call the reactionary left, because I think the boot is now on the other foot, the reactionary left is much given to sneering, as if by reflex, at the deeply felt moral concerns of others. I had a fairly fierce exchange with a member of your staff on Start of the Week a few hours ago, Monday, on her use of the phrase or the term moral panic. Now, to diagnose the moral concerns of others about educational standards, about violence, about family dissolution, in well-paid newspaper columns usually, as moral panic, the moral panic of the anxious and dismayed, seems to me to be no better than a form of sneering. One such sneerer recently referred, very unamusingly, I thought, to the sounds of barking from David Alton, whom I'm glad to say is here this evening. The sounds of barking from David Alton, who said this scribbler, whose name I'll not repeat, is demanding a royal commission, and probably an inquisition too, he said, on the effects of televised video violence. Now, I don't want to enter that particular debate tonight, save to ask this, something which has occurred to me as I've sat considering this talk and the description of David Alton's barking. Isn't it strange to deny a nexus between televised violence and violent conduct when the entire world of advertising, sustained by an expenditure of billions per annum, rests upon the assumption that advertised images not only shape choice, but determine behaviour? These are very simple thoughts. If one, why not the other? Or am I missing something? There may be somebody to tell me that I am missing everything. Well, I'll be glad to hear about it. Now, I consider this to be an acivic left underworld out of which these sentiments spring, where every smile dies upon the lips, where insistence on school sport, I saw from Italy, becomes fascism, where moral expectation of the fulfillment of parental obligations, my obligations as a parent, your obligations as parents, become parent bashing, where the creation of the national curriculum, with all its flaws and with all the arguments that might be mounted against it, becomes an attack, as I saw it described in The Guardian by a very well-known commentator indeed, whose name will not cross my lips, as an attack on cultural deviance. Alarm about juvenile crime, said this leading authority on the subject, was said to reveal a generalized animus towards young people. I've even read recently in The Guardian that that a liberal culture looked at from here, probably, I presume, The Guardian office, hardly exists at all. But no, a true tyranny, a truly illiberal culture, a true fascism, a truly generalized animus towards part of the citizen body, something of which I may say the Jews understand a great deal, and such judgments become not silly, we shouldn't make that mistake, but in my view, indecent. Like Petruchio in The Taming of the Shrew, all these authors are very honest fellows who hardly speak a word of truth. Now, while this is going on, all the while, old socialists are looking for a cause in the midst of this sneering and bad faith. They themselves are looking for a cause. We're all looking for a cause, or more banal, a big idea, without being able to find it or put it into words. But it's here, under our very noses, as one of the Labour contestants has begun most timidly to discover. So timidly that I may say I fear for the future of his leadership. That is what I have called a socialism which rests upon the reciprocal fulfilment of the duties of the citizen and the civic order. Now, there are some who have been offended by the first chapter of my book, which contains some ruderies on the subject of my once fellow academics. Those ruderies derive from the belief that it is a particular failure of academia that it has not addressed itself ethically and practically to its civic tasks. This is an old complaint. The wonderful Henry David Thoreau, in 1854, complained that there are many professors of philosophy, but not many philosophers. He said that to be a philosopher is not enough to have subtle thoughts. And my God, if only they had those. But to solve some of the problems of life, or at least to try to do so. If I can be very nasty, and I can sometimes without trying, there's a peculiarly unpleasant combination of mediocrity, intellectual inactivity, and snobbery, characterizing a great deal of senior common room life in the old universities. I don't think that I ought to say it here, perhaps. But many of us who've been through all this know it to be so, but taboo stops us saying it. On Coco's little list in the Mikado, rather few of its denizens would be missed. My bitter experience was that they inhabit not so much the groves of academia, groves of academe, but a rank intellectual undergrowth, which rarely sees the creative light, and where only dismal footnotes flourish. Of course, I should be mistaken when I say, misunderstood, willfully probably, when I cite Jean-Paul Marat, who in 1791, in a famous pamphlet, against the old French academies, described them very harshly as centres of charlatanism, I wouldn't go that far, whose members have, this is a brilliant, for me, brilliant aperçu, whose members have empty heads but believe that they know everything. Some of our sophists, one of whom I had to engage on Start of the Week, seem positively to have been trained intellectually to cloud every issue and to depress every original thought. And this is a very serious criticism, because none know it better than generation after generation of luckless students who are forced to submit themselves and their better judgment when they set out to this sort of thing. Montaigne, who's one of my favourite writers, I can see the first few people looking at their wristwatches, are much disposed to defend themselves when faced with this sort of challenge, as I have tried to mount in my book, my own book, with what he called, so delightfully, thorny quiddities of logic, whereby our life can in no way be amended, our civic life above all. I've tried in my own way to do something about this. I've done it from a sense of a pressing need and therefore obligation to find civic remedies and to use what intellect I possess to address the woes and ills which afflict the civic order. I can say as an aside that a smart aleck who reviewed my book The Spirit of the Age in The Independent, once I began to address myself to these civic ills and woes, declared in his review, a declaration which was reproduced in the headline of the piece, "Oy vey." This was cynical smart aleckry, or worse. In times, as in these last months, to choose at random, and I am choosing at random, as I did in The Spirit of the Age, in times when there have come before the British courts a man of 27 charged with raping his mother in Redcar in Cleveland, a boy of 13 stabbing to death an 85-year-old former head teacher on her way to church in Wimborne in Dorset. A man, almost unreadable, some of these things. Certainly difficult to read them out, and forgive me. A man of 30 for raping his 13-month-old daughter in Exeter. Four youths aged 17 to 20 who showed no remorse in court, a most chilling comment on them, for kicking to death a man who remonstrated with them, you know this case, for vandalising a traffic bollard in Cardiff. A man aged 25 for beating and kicking to death a part-time supermarket assistant, poor young lad of 17, a student working in a supermarket, who had pursued the former outside the store for shoplifting in Plymouth, and so on and so forth. Now, does it matter civically? I think it does. Is the tawdry exclamation oy vey an adequate response? I don't think it is. Though much can be made of the statistics of crime, and much misuse made of the statistics of crime, in Britain in the last 5 years, the crime rate, especially the rate of violent crime, has recorded its biggest increase. And there will be disputes about these statistics, but nevertheless, this is what I see, has recorded its biggest increase since records began 137 years ago. There were 5.5 million reported crimes last year, and there were probably, so experts think, about 10 million unreported and unrecorded. And perhaps the worst statistic of all, only 1 in 50 reported crimes, I don't speak of the unreported, 1 in 50 reported crimes only led to a conviction. I read a little observed report, which was published in October 1992 by the University of Edinburgh's Criminology Centre, and there will be many fastidious intellectuals now perhaps going into recoil from the use of these statistics and quick perhaps to spring to their feet, denying that they're true or introducing glosses which will merely confuse public debate. A report from Edinburgh University Criminology Unit that was published in October 1992 based on interviews with 4,000 children between the ages of 11 and 15 found that 2/3 had committed a crime ranging from vandalism and shoplifting to housebreaking and car theft within the last 9 months, between 11 and 15. Does it matter civically? I think it does, very much. Things have gone further. In Los Angeles, last year, 1,403 weapons were confiscated from school children, including 405 guns and 527 knives and daggers. 33 of the guns were confiscated from children under the age of 12. Does it matter to us, in our corrupted liberal orders, that in the past 3 decades in the United States, 1.2 million Americans have committed suicide or been murdered? Does it matter? Obviously it does. But there is a rising scale of attacks in Britain, a thing which particularly exercises me whenever I hear of it, on public servants. Prison staff, police, teachers, hospital and community nurses, and doctors on duty. My father, whose papers I'm editing, was a general practitioner and a hospital physician from 1929 to 1973, working mainly in working class areas of London, South Wales, and Lancashire, where I was brought up. I know, both from my knowledge of him and from his papers, that nothing like that ever happened to him. Yet in a survey published in April this year, it was said that one in three London doctors reported that they had been threatened while going about their work, and one in ten had been attacked. Is oy vey enough? Of course not. Now, finally, as citizens, should we not be responding, whether we be self-proclaimed intellectuals or whatever we be, with all the civic energy that is in us, against this sort of thing, and not only against this, but against the wrecking of civic institutions by the government? St. Bart's, for one. Action of the government itself, helping to dissolve, to disintegrate those institutions which give us our sense of civic pride, our sense of civic belonging, and help us to know who we are and where we are and what it is we belong to. The wonderful Thoreau said, "How can you expect the birds to sing when the trees have been cut down?" Should we not be responding against the obstacles? This is a taboo subject, I know this as a former teacher, which are being set in the path of necessary educational reform by teachers' vested interests, ignorantly represented. Why are we so afraid of saying so? What manner of civic triumph, I saw the word triumph used, what manner of civic triumph is it to have slashed, which is a very ugly and violent word, by the way, of the school curriculum, or to have held the line, that's another phrase I've seen, against school testing, when according to the government's adult literacy unit, 60% of our 21-year-olds cannot add up four prices? These are simple questions. You may think them simplistic, and doubtless there will be many, some, ready to confuse the issue with what Montaigne called logical quiddities, designed to throw grit in our eyes when we begin to address these fundamental civic issues. Now, I believe that the less skill, the less employable. I think everybody knows that. So I'm quite unclear as to what social policy, let alone socialist policy, the NUT is pursuing. But take a more serious question, perhaps. Since when has the civic body, the citizen body, order, not required to be ethically educated? Has there ever been a time in the history of human civic association when citizens did not require to be ethically educated? Is our civic order sui generis? It would seem from some of the special pleading that it is, and exempt from the common practice of mankind since human association began? And another interesting question for me, and a very important question for me, how long will it be left, continue to be left, to choleric reactionaries, and I most definitely do not consider myself to be one, purple about the gills, bristling with unreason, how long is it going to be left to them to speak for the widespread dismay of what I call the moderate homme moyen or femme moyenne about our civic condition? Why should they monopolise debate about issues on which we feel a common anxiety without being extreme, reactionary, choleric, and the rest of it? I believe that this homme moyen or femme moyenne is increasingly and justly alarmed by the scale of family breakdown, educational failure, and random violence without being a choleric, bristling, purple-faced reactionary. He is nauseated, I believe, by the daily suborning of his integrity and sense of truth in the tabloid or plebeian press. I think he's very dispirited by the inadequacies, especially the inadequacies of character and intelligence in some of our political leaders. I believe some of them, why don't we have the courage to say it, put this nation to shame? And this is not a party matter. But what an opportunity there is for a civic politics now, at the heart of which will, I believe, stand the principle of duty, both as it applies to the obligations of the civic order to the citizen and of the citizen to the civic order, to sweep all before it. I think it is an opportunity which presents itself alike to the left, the right, and the centre, words which for me now have little remaining meaning. Now, the most immodest claim that I make, it is a terrible, terribly immodest thing to do. Perhaps I won't be forgiven for it, but I make the immodest claim that in the principle of duty I have given the grounds and the vocabulary with which to do it, even if the forms of the argument and the conclusions may not be agreed with. I think millions in their hearts demand a civic politics, and as more British police strap on their holsters, I think that the less understanding and the less the voluntary observance of the principle of duty, the greater will become the need in our precious liberal civic order, as it enters into quickening disaggregation, for the enforcement of the principle of duty by varieties of sanction that nobody, including me, would want to see. I have tried to bring the principle of duty, let me finish by saying, which I consider to be that great neglected rule, from the shadows into which it's been cast. That is all I've done. I haven't invented it. From the shadows into which it's been cast by the politics of rights. I believe that the great social question of the day, which once in the early 19th century gave its name to socialism, is the question of the condition and health of the civic order. There is no reason why a new civic social philosophy should not also lay claim to be a new civic socialism. When a drunken driver of 20, who's just killed two small girls, can protest to the police, "Look at the state of my car," as was cited in evidence in court in April 1993, when a Birmingham housing estate, which can't be protected from vandals, has to be pulled down, bulldozed, in June 1993, when a child of 10, as in the Bulger case, accused of the murder of a two-year-old child, sought to exculpate himself when being questioned by the police with the extraordinary argument, "He didn't do it. If I wanted to kill a baby," he said, "I would kill my own. That is a sibling." Most tragic of all, when a Brent pensioner can lie dead and undiscovered in his flat for 3 years, his body came to light in March 1994, then the citizen in all of us cries out against it. Now, in response to this and many other things, for all its faults, the principle of duty was the best that I could do. In my own life, I may say I have not lived up to my own injunctions. There are many duties which I have not fulfilled myself. But, if I can quote the marvellous Thoreau again, "My shortcomings and inconsistencies don't affect the truth of my statements." Well, I've talked tonight somewhat as I write, contrary to Hazlitt's instruction and advice. I apologise for that if it has been tedious and oppressive. I now have to leave the fate of my book to others, hoping that the foundations of a renewed civic philosophy have been laid in the interests of the well-being of all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David, and thank you all for that remarkable response and well-deserved response to a remarkable address tonight. I would not be surprised if he had raised a few questions that required some answering, and David will now attempt to answer them. Can I just say one practical thing? There are two microphones downstairs, and anybody who wishes to ask a question downstairs can use a microphone. I'm afraid those of you who are upstairs, and I can see some distinguished public figures up there, will have to use your best public skills and speak up very loudly. So who would like to ask the first question? Sir, in the middle, with the T-shirt bit.
Thanks for that. That was great talk. I was interested in what you said about the breakup of the state and civic institutions. I'm a young businessman, and I have a number of friends who are starting their own businesses, and one of the disillusionments that we face is that it seems more and more that people in government do not and appear not to be able to manage anything and produce results. They argue a lot. Now, I don't see why, if there is a principle of duty, or if duties are taken on by businessmen, such institutions as Marks and Spencers and ICI come to mind, you can be proud of those things, and they can have a responsibility to the order. Why could not the government be more of a rule maker and more of an organiser and not necessarily a manager? I mean, surely the failure of any kind of collective management systems in Russia and in China is evidence that governments cannot manage and organise things. Businesses are better doing that, and the government should do more of what you're attempting to do, which is set out the rules of how we should all relate to each other and how we should get on with things.
Thank you very much.
Well, one can't be opposed to the free market in principle. It isn't an ethical principle which commands my loyalty to deny some of the basic principles of the free market. However, there is also a line to be drawn around those civic institutions which give us our sense of belonging. If you carry the logic of privatization to the point at which you reduce the state and its institutions to a nugatory content, merely marginal, the minimum, the absolute minimum, which you can in the interests of cost cutting and so on, you are actually undermining the whole order, the whole civic order. So I agree with you that the state may mismanage under conditions of public ownership, as the socialist system has shown. But it doesn't follow from that that because of the failure of state socialism in the form that it took in the Soviet Union and other countries, that the state has no obligations of a civic kind to make rules for it, as you say. So I don't disagree with what you're saying.
But surely...
No, I don't think we can have a dialogue, though attractive though that might be. So in the front row at the top.
Just following on from that point, I rather agree with the gentleman who's just spoken, in that it seems to me that one of the points you're making is almost the contention that privatization to core is inimical to civic institutions. I agree that certain types of privatization can be wrong, and we've seen, you can take examples from the Ancien Régime in France or from Latter-day Eastern Europe to see that venality and corruption can be one consequence of privatization that is done badly. But it seems like there are two reasons why privatization, if done well, can be good. One is that over time, certain things have come into the state sector which really don't belong there. And to reject privatization at all is to be arguing in favor of a sort of acquis statutaire, anything that, for whatever reason, has come into the state.
I'm not rejecting. I'm not.
And the second argument is that there are some things where, although the state should retain control over the parameters of what is done, the actual business on a day-to-day level can be performed much more efficiently, much more cheaply, much more to the benefit of the citizens, and if the state retains all those functions itself, so that privatization properly done can in fact strengthen the civic order rather than undermine.
Yes, but I also hear between the lines of your argument that something significant of the reaction there has been to the failure of state socialism. It has been to elevate the market principle as an article of faith to the point at which nothing is felt to be immune from it. Now, I know that you're not saying that, but that the problem, one of the problems, side effects of the defeat of socialism is that the market principle has become, as Marxists used to call it, hegemonic, to the point at which it has been extended into realms where it most certainly does not belong, to the damage of the very civic institutions which sustain the coherence of the order to which we belong. This is without disagreeing with some of the points you're making about the management of business or the points that the other speaker made before. What distresses me is that the civic necessities which are involved in the management of any society, by any government, under any regime, and under any form of political economy, have been lost sight of. The fact that so few lawyers, politicians, clergymen have found the strength of argument to defend our civic society from it does show how hegemonic the market principle has become. It's very hard to argue for the restoration of our civic institutions in the teeth of the whole-hogging privatizer. And I think that many well-intentioned right-wing thinkers who've elevated the market principle in this fashion have also gone further to jettison any sense of the privileged place that many civic institutions possess, including institutions which were under state ownership in the Soviet Union. It seems to me absolutely unconscionable that in the name of privatization and the more efficient management of the national economy, certain kinds of institutions which are involved in the provision of public services to the citizens, and this is a citizen service, should fall into the hands of self-interest alone.
Sir,
do you consider setting aside the corruption of certain politicians in Italy that there is a greater sense of civic responsibility among the Italians, perhaps based on the strength of their family?
Well, that is a wonderfully inviting question. I wish I could talk about that for a long time. Italy, for anybody who knows it at all well, it's a very paradoxical and complicated society. I mean, it's as complicated for an Englishman and difficult for an Englishman to understand Italy as it is, as Italian press reveals, Italians to understand England. I mean, I've never read such codswallop about England since I went to Italy. The Italians have been described by academics in the past as not being capable of a civic consciousness because too preoccupied with family, loyalty, and obligation. I find that not to be the case, but I live in a small town in central Italy where the civic sense is very vivid. The civic order is not in the least opaque. It is quite clear who the citizens are. They know each other, and they have the benefit of the small scale, which makes it so difficult to maintain the civic sense in the great metropolises, conversely. I think that the Italians are a much more civic people than we are, from certain points of view. They have a very strong sense, not only of national identity, which we have too, but of civic identity. It may be pejoratively described as campanilismo, but the Italians' pride of place, which is also an extension, one might think, of pride in their families, they're conjoined in a complicated way, which I can't go into now, gives the social fabric of the civic order, a resilience and strength which, from a distance, I admire. They have a sense of place. They have a sense of belonging. I'm speaking of the town which I, by fortune, have inhabited for a short while, may not be permanent. There is a place for old and young alike. In the particular town in which I live, there's been no crime of violence since 1945. These are, obviously, you might say, special circumstances, but I can see in microcosm, and indeed it was one of the inspirations for my book, how a civic order might be, should be, and how I believe it can be reconstituted, because there is in all of us, Italian or not, the same kind of civic sense and civic identity, so suppressed in ours, latent, defeated, dismayed, anxious, but nevertheless waiting to be aroused. But I agree with your main contention, I think your implication, your question, that there's something in Italy that we do not possess.
The lady who had her hand up right in the back.
Well, I remember reading some comparative literacy statistics which reveal that after the Victorian Education Acts, the standards of literacy fell in Britain, and that incoming prisoners into the jail of Manchester, as Roberts revealed in his great book, The Classic Slum, were signing their names with crosses in the late part of the 19th century, but were perfectly capable of writing their names in the register when admitted as prisoners, convicts, in the mid-19th century. You see, I have seen as a teacher and somebody who was relatively well taught and privileged to be at one of Britain's great grammar schools, Manchester Grammar School, that the key to what we learned was this dreadful, supposedly quasi-fascist word, a discipline. We actually had to work extremely hard. And by fortune, because I came from a so-called bourgeois family, I was sustained at home by parents who felt that it was necessary for me to be educated in order to prosper, and necessary to be educated in order to be civil and decent too, and to know how to comport myself as a citizen among other citizens. That ethic still survived in my upbringing, and it did in the general spirit of the school. We have lived through an educational revolution in which new teaching methods have come forward, which have disabled the old, which have cast doubt about their efficacy. I think that teachers have lost their way and their pupils with them because of the multiplicity of methods which have been employed and the doubt which has been cast about the methods which were tried in the past. I also think, and I feel this very bitterly, as a former member of a trade union and indeed a teacher at Ruskin, which is a college of the trade union movement, as I said, was bold enough or rash enough to say in the Times, I believe, and I'll say it here, that the NUT has comported itself in a fashion which makes it, in effect, an enemy of good government and an enemy of the interests of the civic order. And I'll say it again here, that I think the government... I think the government should have been harder, tougher on them than it has been. I also think, this is not something which an old socialist is supposed to say, that John Patton has put up a tremendously manful struggle, errors and all, in attempting to create a national curriculum to increase the volume of testing and to raise the standards of the pupils leaving school. I think he could have done no less. I think he should have been celebrated by the nation rather than marginalised. And if, in the coming reshuffle, he's to be cast into outer space by the Prime Minister, I think that will be a disastrous comment on the efforts of a person I consider to be ethically good, attempting as best he can to do what I would like him to do, and which I wouldn't be surprised if the great majority of the British people want to see him succeed in doing.
So, go to the microphone, please.
I would like to ask you a question. People believe that you're a genius.
Do they? Nobody's said that to me yet. a genius.
You don't come to any conclusion. Everything you said is true. You haven't spoken about the monarchy, the attacks on the monarchy. Once you start with that, and if you have a death wish, and you're accident prone for 50 years or more since the Second World War, what would you have written? What would you have said tonight? God forbid, Chas v'cholile, if you were in 14 camps like me, and you regretted every day that you're alive since 1945 or 41, if you had come out of any of the camps in the East, what would you have written? Primo Levi committed suicide very late. Another one in France, a famous philosopher, writer, committed suicide. Isaac Balcevis Singer never wrote a word about the so-called Holocaust. How do you know that in 15 years, I hope you're alive, how do you know there won't be concentration camps in Britain? What proof can you give me? I can prove that there will be, but you prove to me. Mr. Stothard is going to print something about me now. He was told last week by the chairman to do it.
I think, David, would you like to...
Well, I mean, that's a terrifying story, and my heart goes out to you if you've suffered in this way. But just a minute. I can't prove anything about the future. How can I make... adduce a future proof about something which has not taken place. I don't believe there will be concentration camps in Britain in the future, provided that the civic order is protected and preserved, and if citizens fulfil their duties to it, and it fulfils its duties as citizens in the way in which I, with temerity, set out in my book.
The lady in yellow at the back. You have to speak up quite loudly from there in order to be heard over there.
Okay, Chairman, I've got a loud voice. In the area of crime, and obviously it's very pertinent, I think, what the author of the book has said this evening. I've not had a chance yet to read it, so please bear with me. But when we look at child criminals, for example, or the young, which you have covered in the lecture tonight, I do despair when we all hear, obviously every time something awful happens, everybody backs off and says, oh God, isn't that dreadful? And where I further despair is that when we look at the amount of groups, and I have a great fear now, the amount of so-called pressure groups which are being set up to progress forward minority feelings and views all the time, those that are always pandering to those poor people who've committed these crimes, when there is probably one group set up who is trying to deal with the victims of these crimes, how the heck are we supposed to go forward in society and really get into balance how serious these crimes are? As a society, and we fought world wars over this, we fought the wars to turn around and say, of course we have freedom of expression, of course we don't want anybody to be suppressed here, but getting back to what this book is about, on the rights of people, I am sick and tired of the rights and the rights and the rights without that responsibility. So how do we, the majority, actually get the responsibility into people's minds to move forward and make things better?
Well, we can start. We can start by choosing politicians who have a civic agenda and whose politics are civic in the sense in which I've been trying to describe. We are, for the most part, tired of the out-of-date arguments of left and right constructed on the basis of shibboleths which no longer have meaning even for old ideologists of my vintage who lived their lives by the existing ideology, kept within its parameters, and felt scared of stepping one inch outside their bounds. Now we are freed by failure, the failures of the left and right, to think again. And I believe the rethinking is going to take civic forms. Now, I heard you, if I could just say, you seem to be referring to minorities or suggesting that there's something wrong with our plural society and that there are too many groups agitating for minorities. I don't agree with that. I think that this is, better or worse, a plural society. It has a constellation of interests composed within it. But as I've tried to show in my book, that is not incompatible with there being a common ethical direction in society. People may have their faiths, their beliefs, their commitments, their ideals, whether as members of families or members of faiths, but that does not in any way foreclose, or is not in any way incompatible with the existence of a common ethical direction. You raised the question of the Jews. I don't want to pursue this too far because I'm not sure where we will end. But I believe that in general, though there have been acivic and wicked members of the Jewish faith, one immediately springs to mind in the media, who fell overboard or was pushed overboard from his ocean-going yacht. Pushed, probably. I believe that with all their faults, like any other human group, the Jews have somehow managed both to be loyal to what they believe and to be relatively good citizens. You see, it's on that basis that I think it is possible to be both what somebody might disparagingly call a member of an ethnic minority and a good citizen. It's possible to be a member of an ethnic minority and to be a most decidedly bad citizen. But as I've said in my book many times, the problem in our society is not the ethnic stranger. I hate that. Naturally, I would. It's not the ethnic stranger. It's the ethical stranger.
Now, I know that there are some various problems tonight because there are people worried about trains. Normally, when you see people leaving, they reckon it's time to stop. But I've got a sense that some people here would like to continue this a little longer. Perhaps if that is correct, I should like to take the gentleman actually behind the lady in blue, I address first.
Thank you for your talk. You talk of a civic order, but I see a problem there because some person's idea of your civic order may not be the same as their civic order. If they have five palaces and the other person's on the streets, their view of the civic order may be different. Can you tell me where you ground your truth statement?
They may have a different view of the civic order, but they're both members of it. The fact that the civic order is invisible to many citizens is a problem of the disaggregation, dissolution of the civic sense. It doesn't mean the civic order is not there. The fact that we are relatively unaware of it, we've been deprived of our knowledge of it. We are strangers to one another. The principles of the civic order, which I repeat, I have not invented, I have simply declared them on the basis of my reading of civic philosophers, political philosophers in the past. There is, it could be said, absolutely not a single new sentence in the book from beginning to end. When you ask me where my truth statements come from, they rest upon, this will not be satisfactory to an academic if that's what you are, the combined wisdom inherited in our Judeo-Christian society and Greco-Roman based society too, in terms of its political and moral principles, accumulated over centuries and passed down to us. We are the heirs of it. And I will, to my dying day, seek to keep alive that tradition of civic philosophical thinking without claiming special wisdom, because I think it is the duty of any intellectual like myself, otherwise idle, to think and to write and to speak civically in the interests of all. This is quite without denying the implication of your view that there may be many different opinions of the quality of the civic order to which we belong, but the existence of the civic order is not in doubt. Where is the civic order, somebody said to me today. What is the civic order? Indeed, it was Mary Warnock yesterday, if I'm accurate, who said, this notion of the civic order is a very abstract thing, isn't it? Well, we are the civic order. It's very concrete. We, common citizens of a common polity or body politic, an aggregate of citizens, whether we know we are citizens or not, or whether we care whether we're citizens or not, live under common rule in this society. This society, for all its defects, possesses a common ethical direction, broadly speaking, a liberal, democratic, Judeo-Christian direction, however attenuated And indeed, I don't think it is particularly attenuated. I think it's very strong under the surface of our thoughts and in our lives and in our assumptions and in our habits. And provided that it is governed by the principle of duty, as well as by the principle of right, but the principle of duty having ethical precedence, then our civic order can and will prosper. But there can't be any doubt the civic order exists. We are parties to it.
Thank you. I think I should probably take two more questions. There's a lady in the white at the back who's been patient and anxious to speak, and I would now invite her to do so, and then I'll take one further question after that.
Second point, you referred to the value of nationwide community service. How could this value be communicated to Treasury objectors?
Well, very good question. The first part of your question, the answer to that is that we have seen, under the pressure of anti-ethical and certainly acivic thinking on the part of lobbies, a retreat from otherwise brave and bold individuals in government with clear objectives, who've been forced onto the defensive by acivic, anti-civic and anti-social agitation of a kind which is unworthy of a citizen. We have to agree that we have a common civic interest, that our educational standards should be raised. There are many teachers. I'm among the first to salute the terrific efforts of teachers, often in very difficult circumstances, and yes, short of resources, to teach what they need to teach to their pupils. But I will not, I absolutely refuse to put first on my agenda the question of resources. I think that that is an absolute evasion of the fundamental moral or ethical issue. Can I just add, I don't want to be misinterpreted, because I shall see that not only have I been accused of fascism today, but I may be accused of being a Maoist also, if I say that I recall during the Cultural Revolution, when I visited China, asking an old peasant, one of those old peasants who may, for all I know, have been wheeled on to persuade me of the great virtues of the Cultural Revolution, who said to me when I asked, well, how did you manage to create such an enormous scale of literacy in China during the process of the revolution and thereafter, with such a vast population, so poor, without the NUT's resources? And you know what he answered? He crouched down in the ground, he extended the index finger of his right hand, and he drew a Chinese letter in the dust. We didn't need resources, he said. Provided you have a finger and the dust, you can teach anybody to read and write.
To you, sir, the last question on this night.
Your talk reminds me very strongly of...
Could you speak right up? What happened to the microphone? Here we are.
Your talk reminds me very strongly of the words of Michael Howard, who said at the end of war in European society, in describing post-war society,
that
the society he was talking about in 1973, and in particular of the youth of that society, found it so self-evidently better to make love rather than war. And in my words, I would call that a simplistic society.
No, I'm old, and I'm not that old that I can't remember that is true.
What I would suggest is that rather than follow a progressive path from the Greco-Roman birth of society, of liberal democracy, modern society has actually declined since the very strong sense of civic responsibility of the Victorian and Edwardian era. And having declined since then, and we may see the resurgence of that very strong sense of responsibility, I'd just like to question, without criticizing your talk in any way, how that sense of responsibility can be reawakened or can be communicated from society, from those within society who find that a value, to those who find it a abstract concept.
Well, you may be embarrassed if I say this to you, that if there are more people like you in society, then it will be. It is your task. You are the coming generation. You're probably under 30. I'm sure you are. And it's a wonderful thing to hear you say that. It is what I have written my book in the hope of eliciting. You must give the answer to that. It's the task of your generation, as ours passes from the scene, to arouse again in your peers and in those whom you may come to influence precisely this sense of responsibility which you have found in your own inheritance as an educated young person in this society. You are the hope of the future, and it will come through education being conducted. The principles that you would wish to see espoused by others being disseminated by you, because it can't be disseminated by others, you must do it. Each of us has his or her own civic responsibility. All I have tried to do is to discharge mine by writing this book. More than that, I can't recommend. I try to disclose what these principles are for the interest, encouragement, and arousing of expectation of a better future than the one that we hand over to you in the future, and that I hope will happen.
Thank you very much indeed, David. Thank you. Also. Thank you all very much. I know that those of you who have not yet bought books or would like to buy books or would like David to sign books, he will be here ready to do that for you for a few minutes after this is over. So thank you all very much for coming. Thank you.